Take your Bibles, turn them to Job chapter 1. It's good to have you here. The question we're going to be wrestling with today is a question I think all of us have wrestled with at one time or another, or we will. There's not, I don't think, any one of us who is going to be exempt, and that is the question of why do bad things happen to good people? Well, I want to walk through the book of, or I should say the first chapter and a bit of Job, Job chapter 1. We're going to look at Job 1 to verses 10 in chapter 2. I want to give a couple of preface statements as you try to find Job. Job's just left of Psalms, so you can kind of, you know, open up. Most of us can find Psalms because it's such a book, big book, but Job is just to the left of it. We're going to look at, like I said, the first chapter and then the 10 verses that begin chapter 2. Let me give you some preface statements. And I normally don't outline things for you, but I want to outline things today as it pertains to this subject because it is such a weighty one. It's one that many of us, it's going to apply right now. Some of you are going to really, and I say this occasionally flippantly. I shouldn't say flippantly, jokingly, but I don't mean it flippantly, if that's possible. And that is, this is going to be a hard one. It's going to challenge you. Some of you are going to really just want to get up and leave. Don't. We take pictures. We'll post them on the internet. It's just the way we are. And so we'll walk through, but it's going to be hard. It's hard preaching on this. In fact, I don't think I could have preached on this, although I may have taught on Job before. I actually have. I've taught through the whole book of Job, which is a grunt work, by the way. But I've taught on the whole book of Job before. But I don't think I could have taught on this as it pertains to the subject matter today and things we're going to walk through 10 years ago, 5 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago. It's going to be weighty. It's going to be hard. It's going to challenge you, I think, because it's going to require that you ask some big questions, the most significant one being, who do I live for? Whose glory do I seek? And if you're not prepared to wrestle with that question, you're going to really have a tough time with what we're going to look at today. Because we're going to deal with the subject matter of why do hard things happen to good people. Now, you could even challenge the question whether it's even pertinent, but for argument's sake, let's let it hang out there. Here's my four preface statements. Number one preface statement is this. Although the Bible has much to say on the topic of suffering and the reasons for it, it does not answer the question as it pertains to our specific situations. And what I mean by that is, although when we read the scriptures, we're privy to insider information, so to speak. We looked at insider information as it pertained to Abraham, Sarah, and Isaac. Why did they have such a tough time getting pregnant? Why did it take so long? What was God up to? They never get the answer, quite frankly. They just live their lives. They have to persevere. They have to demonstrate faith. They do all of those things. We're given information. We're privy to it. In the annals of time, literally thousands of years later, Paul gives some added commentary and says, this is why this took place. But they didn't get any. They just lived their lives. And we're going to see that in Job as well. We're given insider information. We're given the back and forth between God and Satan, the reason why things take place, but he isn't. In fact, God never answers the specific why question to Job. He doesn't. So we need to understand that. And that leads to my second preface statement, and I'm borrowing this thought, and I'm borrowing a lot of thoughts today. I just did a lot of reading, a lot of studying, not to brag about that. That's not my point. My point is, you want to be as well-read on this, well-listened on this, all of that as possible. So there's a lot of things out I'm just going to throw out there, and so I just want you to know that from the outset. But tied into this, second preface statement is that our becoming more like the person, like the people that God intended for us to be, is for us to suffer, requires us to suffer, and not know the reason why. For us to be the people that God intends us to be, requires that we suffer and not know the reason why. And to paraphrase one writer on this topic, he put it this way, we should not simply resign to that fact, but we need to embrace it. The fact of the matter is, one of the things that I think really drives us crazy in the North American version of Christianity is that we have not embraced the fact that part of our faith is mysterious and tension-filled. We do not see everything clearly on this side of heaven. And we hate that. We do. We hate that. I'll just stop there. Third preface statement is this. Although we don't have the luxury of knowing the specific answers to the question why, as it pertains to our lives, your life, my life, you're going through a hard time, why God? Why God? Why is this going on? The Bible does give many large, overarching answers to the question that do pertain to our specific situations. I want us to know that. The Bible speaks to the subject of suffering, the reasons for it, the benefits of it, the purpose, all of that stuff. It talks about a lot. But here's what I want to say in light of that. Even though we ask the question, why a lot, I'm not really convinced, the more I live my life, that we really want the answer. I'm just not convinced we really want the answer. Or to put it another way, I don't think we want the answer the Bible gives. And the reason why I say that is because, and I said it sort of gave a snippet on the front end, is that the answer that the Bible gives is tied in with who we want to see most glorified in our lives. And I'm not sure we really want to wrestle with that. Because quite honestly, Westside, it's easy to see who's most glorified in our lives when suffering occurs. It's really easy to see. So we're going to wrestle with that. Last preface comment. As we continue on in this series of finding Jesus in the Old Testament, it's my contention that there is no more important topic than the topic of suffering to find Jesus in. I think the topic of suffering is, I would argue, the most important topic in all of the scripture to find Jesus in. The topic of suffering is such, if you believe in an all-powerful, all-knowing, sovereign God, that if we don't wrestle with the question, how does God answer it? What is his response to it? And if we don't come to a place where we see Jesus, I can't speak for you, but for me, I would not believe in an all-knowing, all-powerful, all-loving God in the presence of evil and suffering if it wasn't for Jesus. I just wouldn't. It's way too big and meaty a subject, as I think there is in all of the scriptures. But the fact of the matter is, Jesus is there. And he answers to me the question, why? And God, what are you doing? And that is the answer the atheist doesn't have. See, the problem of evil and suffering is a greater problem for the atheist than the one who believes in God. Because we have an answer to why it exists and how it's going to be dealt with. The atheist does not, which means they live a life without hope. They can say, we're evolving, we're getting better. In the light of history, with the 20th century being the most bloody century in the history of mankind, you have a big, big dilemma on how you answer that. If you believe if mankind is inherently good, you've got a big problem. Just walk outside your door. So we're going to look at Jesus, as we always do. Because everything was created by him and for him. He holds everything together. If there was no Jesus, we would be. Okay, let's go. Verse 1. Okay, that's my preface statement. Statements. I'm going to fly over. This is going to be a sober message. Cool with that? I hope so. We'll see. We'll see who's standing here at the end, if it's me and my mom at the end. Hey, how you doing? Good to see you. All right, verse 1. Job chapter 1. In Job chapter 1, and this is a flyover, I'm just going to be looking down on my notes a lot just to make sure that I hit everything, so forgive me for that, it's the worst way to preach. But in verse 1, we're introduced to Job, and we get a clear sense from the beginning the type of man he was, right? You see it, verse 1, he was blameless, upright, he was one who feared God, meaning he had a holy respect, an awe, a reverence for God inwardly that got manifested outwardly, and he turned away from evil. And right from the beginning, whether you picked it up in verse 1, we get an answer to the question, why here, wrapped up with the answer, why not? Let me explain what I mean by that. Job does not undergo suffering right here in verse 1, as we see, as some sort of punishment for sin. And the reason why I point that out is because many people, especially those in the church who have some sort of belief in a God or God himself, they believe that a lot of their suffering has to do with the fact that God is unhappy with them. Right? God's unhappy with me. He's punishing me. Let me make this statement. It should have been part of my preface statement, but I'll put it here. If you are a follower of Jesus, if you are a Christian, you're a Jesus follower, God does not punish you for your sin. He doesn't. And why can I say that? Because your sin was transferred onto Jesus, and he was punished for your sin. And God does not come after the fact 2,000 years later and begin punishing you for your sin again. Jesus hung on the cross for your sin in the future. He doesn't punish you for your sin. You know why we think that he does? Because we're still the center of our faith and belief system. Do you like that? That's good, wasn't it? We are still the center. Why is that? Because we have a great proclivity or propensity towards religion. And what does religion state? Whatever I do, if it's good, God will give me good things in return. And if I do bad, God will slap my hands. It's religion. It's moralism. It's determinism. It puts us at the center and removes Jesus. And it lessens the work of Jesus on the cross, to which he said, while on the cross, it's finished. It's finished. God does not punish you for your sin. That being said, does he discipline you? Sure he does. But from where does that discipline flow from? Love. Jesus himself in Revelation 3:19 says this, those whom I love, I reprove and discipline. Hebrews 12:6, the Lord disciplines those he loves. But what is his desire? What's his motivation? What does he want to see occur? He wants you and I, if we're followers of Jesus, to become more like Jesus. That's the motivation. But he does not punish us for our sin, but he does reprove us, he does correct us, he does discipline us, but the motivation is an entirely different one. The second way we deal with this, and again, I'm borrowing this thought on how others deal with the problem of sin, problem of evil, some may say, well, it's God getting me back for being a bad dude today. All right, again, very religious, because if God punished us for our sin, Westside, we'd be continually punished. All right, we would live in punishment, we would. And the reason why I say that is because most of us live our lives where if I don't sleep around, if I don't get drunk, right, if I declare everything at the border, everything's going to be fine in my life. We sort of look at sin like that. We sin constantly. Constantly. Here's the second way people deal with the problem of suffering and hardship. They deal with it sort of with a, hey, life's tough attitude. Right? You make your breaks. Sometimes it's a good day. Sometimes it's a bad day. You know what? Sort of this God helps those who help themselves type of mindset. Kind of a cynical mindset. It's that type of attitude. Stuff happens. Life sometimes sucks. That type of mindset. You know, there's a God, but he's not really involved. Right? Not really involved. Many people in church, and I've talked about this a couple weeks ago, and I'll hit it. Remind me at the end if I don't. Someone stand up, just yell at me because I forgot to mention it in the first. Some people say, well, God, he's active in certain events and other things he just sort of lets happen. We're going to hit that. Is that in fact true? He's involved, but other things just kind of occur. And it kind of surprises him. Oh, holy smokes. I didn't know that. Unbelievable. I can't do anything about it. It's already happened. We live our lives like that. It's very common. Very common. Let's look at this. All right, Job chapter 1, good guy. He's not suffering. He's not suffering because of sin. But in the same way, he's not suffering because of randomness. So if you have that mindset, it's defeated in one verse. Right? He's blameless, upright. He's a reverent man, walking with God, all of those things. Doesn't mean he was sinless, but he was blameless. You ever met a person like that? We have people like that in our lives. They're not sinless, but when we think of them, they're upright people of integrity. That's what Job is here. So not sinning, not random. We don't see either of those here. Verses 2 and 3 describes the giving of God to Job. Job will later say at the very end of chapter 1, verses, I think, 19, 20, 21, that the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. This is the giving of God. This is what we see here. He's got seven sons, three daughters, bunch of sheep, camels, oxen, those types of things. He's a very blessed individual in those ways. To summarize his life, we read at the end of verse 3, he was the greatest of all people in the East. And what happens in verse 4 and 5 is we get this little snapshot of his reverence for God. His kids like to get together and celebrate, right? They party all the time. They have big feasts. They're party animals. Not in a bad way. They just like to celebrate. I think partying and celebrating is great. I'm all for it. That's what these guys, they do well. Okay? They get together. They have feasts. And what it says is that every morning thereafter, any of these celebrations, Job would, just look at it in verse 4, five, when the days of run the feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, rise up early in the morning, offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all, just to make sure that they didn't curse God in their hearts. He took care. He was a good dad. He's a good daddy. It's the role of a daddy right here. We get a little snapshot, good role of a daddy. He's a good dad, probably a great husband, all right? It's debatable in terms of her, right? We'll get to her in a second. But that's what we see. We see this reverence for God. He was a good God. He was a good dad. He was a good man. All of this, why am I talking about this? All of this sets up what takes place next. The uprightness of Job, reverence for God, commitment, the blessings of God, all set up what takes place next. Look at verse 13. So on one of these feast days, when all of his children are gathered in the home of the oldest brother, that in verses 14 and 15, a messenger comes to Job and tells him that this group of individuals called the Sabians had attacked and stolen his oxen and donkeys and killed all the servants with them. Wow. Bunch of oxen, bunch of donkeys, bunch of people looking after him. Stolen by these individuals and the servants killed. That's just round one, though. It gets worse. Verse 16. Now the messenger comes, reports that a fire has come. It's destroyed all the sheep and the servants with them. Wow. That's bad news. The paint hasn't even dried on round two before round three starts. Round three takes place in verse 17 when another messenger comes, says that a group of people called the Chaldeans had raided the camel herd, taken them, and killed the servants there. Huh. Wow. Animals gone, servants dead. Sheep dead. I don't know why they didn't take the sheep, but the sheep died as well. All of them gone, servants gone, possessions gone, done. You think that would be bad enough? Round four, happens, takes place, and is the worst of the worst in verses 18 and 19, when a message comes that all of his children were crushed to death, and together they're partying in the oldest brother's house, a great wind comes and causes the house to collapse on them. Unbelievable. All of Job's prosperity is gone in one afternoon, and the question is, why? Right? Why? If there's any situation that deserves the why question, it's this. Why? What in the world is going on? What in the world is going on? I want to paraphrase one commentator speaking into this. He says, for us to get the answer of what in the world is going on, we have to look outside the world. This world alone never answers the great questions of life. The answer is found in heaven. So what the writer does, if you look at verses 6 to 12, is gives us a glimpse into heaven to understand what's happening on earth. Look at verses 6 to 12. Describes this meeting. This is what we're privy to that obviously Job was not privy to. We're privy to this meeting that takes place between God and Satan. And in verse 7, Satan says that he spends time going to and fro on the earth. Then what God does is something kind of freaky. He highlights Job to Satan. Don't you kind of go, okay, God, don't do that to me. All right, I don't want to be highlighted. I just keep me away. I don't want to be brought up. Unless you believe that there's something bigger going on. And so Satan comes, says, I'm going to and fro on the earth. And in verse 8, God asks Satan a question. Have you considered my servant Job? That there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. And what does Satan do? How does he respond? What does he think? Job's a phony. Job's a phony. The only reason Job reveres, lives, fears, you is because of his stuff. Take a look at it. Verse 9, he implies that the only reason Job fears God is because of the things that God has given him. He asks the question, does Job fear God for no reason? Look at his life. Everything he touches turns to gold. You got a hedge of protection around him. No wonder he fears you. No wonder he walks with you. No wonder he loves you. You take that stuff away, he'll curse you to your face. He'll leave you. Which begs the question to us in 2008, does it not? Why do you follow God? So Satan says to God in verse 11, stretch out your hand and touch all that he has and he will curse you to your face. God says in response, behold in verse 12, all that he has is in your hand, only against him do not stretch your hand. Then come the calamities that we went through. Scene 1, 2, 3, and 4. Job loses all of his wealth, all of his children, which again leads to the question, why? What on earth is happening? And the answer to this question, and it begins helping us unpack it, is something heavenly is happening. So what on earth is happening? Something heavenly is happening. Which should remind at least some of us that passage in Ephesians 6, that says, our battle is not against flesh and blood, but we wage war in the heavenlies. Now, do we? Do you and I literally go into the heavenlies? No. But what Paul is saying is that war is being waged. There's something heavenly going on when we are tested. God is demonstrating that Job isn't sort of some kind of hired gun, right? That he's only doing this because of what I get. Highlighting that he himself, if he lived like that, were of no value, that God would be of no value to Job, that Job just follows me because of the stuff. Job's reverence is based on the value of God for who God is in himself. That's the test. That's what's going on. And Westside, and here's something, if you like writing things down, write it down because I think it's good. And that means it doesn't come from me, I'm quoting. The revelation of this truth is so important that God is willing to subject Job to grief and poverty in order to make it known. Let me read that again because that is really, it's important. You need to chew on it. I'll say it again. The revelation of this truth is so important that God is willing to subject Job to grief and poverty to make it known. Remember, we're asking the question, why do hard things happen to good people? Why do we suffer? We start getting a snippet here, and it's all tied into the glory of God. Verses 20 and 21 records the victory. Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell on the ground and worshiped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb. Be weird if he didn't, right? If he came out with clothes, that'd be trippy. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Satan's proved to be wrong. Job didn't curse God when he lost his wealth. He didn't even curse God when he lost his children. He worships, and he blesses God. And so the superior worth of God is demonstrated in Job's life. It's evident to all. And the purpose of God in setting Job up was fulfilled, to display how valuable, how glorified God is in Job's life all by itself, all by himself. That's the test going on. That's what's taking place. That's part of the answer to the why. Let's unpack it even further, because you would think this is enough, right? Chapter 1's done, man. It doesn't get worse. And that's bad. Look at chapter 2. Job is recovering from the shock of all of this. And his children have been lost. He's lost all his wealth. And now he contracts a deadly disease. Look at verses 7 and 8. It says that he was afflicted with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the ground of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery in which to scrape himself, which is, just sounds nasty. Doesn't that sound nasty? It sounds nasty. That's like if you're married to someone who's doing that, he's like, can you do that in another room? Right? That's the kind of thing that's going on here. While he sat in ashes. Why? Is this the reward he gets? Is it? Why is this taking place? What in the world, again, is going on here? And again, the answer is not given in the world, but in heaven. Look at verses 1 to 6. God again puts Job on display before Satan. Verse 3, and the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth? A blameless and upright man who fears God, turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity. Although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. Once again, what Satan is doing is challenging the authenticity of Job's reverence. He says that Job is only reverent because God preserves his health. Look at verses 4 and 5. Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. What's Satan challenging God with again? The worth of God. Right? I mean, that's what's going on here. The worth of God. These things mean more to him. Get rid of them, he'll curse you. His health means more to him. Get rid of that, and he'll curse you. That's the only reason why he worships you. That's the premise. To quote Tim Keller, to paraphrase him because I'll botch this up, Satan does not get love. He doesn't understand love. Is it God himself that Job cherishes, or is it a possession in health? What God is, or what Job has done is shown that God is more valuable to him than any family and his possessions. But what about his health? Verse 6, God says to Satan, behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life. Let me say this. The demonstration of the worth of God in the faith and reverence of his people is the most important matter in all of the world. You want to know why you exist? To display the reverence of God in your life. Nothing more important. But when Job's health fails, it proves to be too much for his wife. She has endured with him the loss of their children, make no mistake, all of their stuff. And now she's watching her husband and his life draining away from him, and she's utterly destitute and her faith collapses. Verse 9, she says, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. And it's my contention that I bet at this point Satan got a little hopeful watching this. But Job responds in verse 10, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil or calamity? In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. What do we see here? This is where it's going to get hard. This is where some of you are going to get really antsy. You're going to want to get up. Comfort and calamities come from the hand of God. Job will not renounce his rock-solid confidence, however, in the sovereignty of God, and neither should we. I want you to listen to Peter's words from 1 Peter 4, and I want you to notice the correlation to the story of Job. Peter writes in 1 Peter 5, if it's on there, if you could put it on there, thank you. Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. It goes on to say, and it's not on the screen, resist him, firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. How do we resist Satan in the midst of our suffering? We do it the same way that Job did it, standing firm in our faith and our reverence for God, trusting that he is sovereign and altogether in control. And what does Satan do when we resist him? He flees. He flees from us. Peter says in the chapter before this, 1 Peter 4, verse 19, he says, therefore, those of us who suffer according to God's will, that opens up a can right there, doesn't it? Whew. What do you mean suffer according to God's will? Man, it's quiet in here. Whoo, boy, it's quiet in here. Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. What do you mean you suffer according to God's will? God does good things and he allows some things to go on. He gives good stuff. not bad stuff. God doesn't will it that we suffer. Got to look ahead to Jesus. We'll get to Jesus in a second. But what do we see here? The whole context of 1 Peter 4, by the way, is if you suffer, suffer for doing good. Don't suffer as a murderer, a thief, a liar, cheater, adulterer, whatever. Don't suffer for those things. If you suffer, suffer for the name of Jesus. Suffer for walking with Jesus. It's the exact same thing as we see in our study of the Sermon on the Mount, especially the Beatitudes, where one of the Beatitudes is, blessed are you when you're persecuted for righteousness' sake. When you are persecuted for my name's sake. When we suffer when we're walking with and for Jesus. So let's walk through this. It's good instruction, but again, it's difficult for, I know, some of us. For it says there in plain language that we can suffer at the will of God. It kind of changes how you pray, doesn't it? I mean, we love to pray for the will of God to happen in our life, right? Really want to know God's will. Really? Really? Are you sure? I think we do, but do we understand how broad that is? And remember what the will of God is according to Romans 12? It's good. It's pleasing. It's perfect. Even the will that calls us to suffer for his name's sake. This is meat stuff. We should be really challenged right here. We got to be really trying to figure something out. So let's do this. Let's unpack this. I want to close our time by highlighting a couple of truths that we see in Job 1 and 2. So we've done the preface, we've done the flyover, and we're going to do some key truths, hit on them. Here's truth number one. Satan's goal is to Satan's goal is to destroy our joy in God. And what weapons does Satan use to destroy our joy in God? Two weapons that we see in Job's life. Pain, pleasure. Right? Pain and pleasure. How does Satan use these two? He uses pain to make us feel that God is powerless and hostile. You ever heard that? You ever heard that? We look at our lives, we look at the world around us, and we see the things that are going on, and we think two things. God is not powerful, obviously, because if he was, he would do something. Or God doesn't care, he stands back, he's not personal, and he's not a loving God. That's common. You hear that on college campuses by people that are supposedly educated. I mean, what else could it be? Couldn't be anything else. So Satan uses pain, but he also uses pleasure. All right? He uses pleasure, and what does pleasure do? It makes us feel that God is unneeded. I got everything. I've got everything. I don't need God. Bank's full. Health is good. My wife, my husband, they're stunning. Sweet ride. Small mortgage. I don't need God. Pain. Pleasure. Think about the people in your life who have never walked with God. Who have never walked with God, or who had at one point walked with God but have walked away from him. Think about their situations, and I guarantee almost to the person, they have walked away because of either pain or pleasure. Something happened, they walked away, they ran, because that's our propensity. We run, we're chicken. We are. We don't want to dig deeper. Or pleasure. Pleasure. Those two things. Satan uses them all the time. I need to take a sip. I hate drinking in front of people. It makes me nervous. I'm going to dribble down my... Now I'm laughing. I can't drink. I need a sippy cup. Oh. That's exactly that truth there. It's not my own. That's exactly what... Obviously, it's not my own. That's exactly what Paul says in Philippians 4. Verses 12 and 13. Philippians 4, 12 and 13, Paul's talking about contentment. And he goes, I've found the secret. I found the secret of contentment. I found the secret of contentment when I have plenty and when I'm in need. Then he quotes, or he states the verse that is probably the most misquoted verse in all of the scripture. I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. To which, in North America in 2008, it's mostly used by athletes who go, you know what, I can bat 350, I can win the Tour de France because like Jesus gives me strength. It's brutal context, brutal application, because what Paul says is I can bat zero, not be able to ride a bike, and I'm content. I can have plenty, I can have nothing. Why? Because I have Jesus. I can have pain, I can have pleasure. I've found contentment in either. Why? Jesus. That's the context of that. So what does Satan do? His goal is to remove our joy. What is God's goal? Second truth, God's goal is to magnify his worth in his people. That's it. That's it. God's goal is to display his glory in his redeemed people. The way he does this is by saving us. And saving us and bringing us to a point where we cherish and love him above all else. But West Side, and here's where it gets really hard. What is the greatest opportunity for the demonstration of the worth and love and value of God in our lives? The greatest opportunity for God's glory to be displayed in our lives is seen in verse 20. Look at it with me. I think it's the key verse of all of the book of Job. Job's lost everything. Verse 20, then Job arose and he tore his robe and he shaved his head. This is mourning. And he fell on his ground, on the ground. And he worshiped. And I guarantee you that angels, if they weren't standing, stood to their feet. And Satan, as all his minions, looked on. And both wondered the same thing. How? What? The answer? The most valuable thing to Job was God himself. And the greatest opportunity to display the glory of God in Job's life was him, while he had lost everything, in his mourning worship. Almost every time you study suffering, especially in the New Testament, you will see connected to it somewhere in the passage, glory or grace. All the time. Why? Again, same answer. It's the greatest opportunity to display the glory of God in our lives. Let me also say this, West Side. Let your tears flow freely when your calamity comes. Don't be fake. See, wailing, grief, tears, mourning are not signs of unbelief. Job knows nothing about being superficial and fake, some sort of, you know, just this mamby-pamby, oh, praise God. The magnificence of Job's worship is because it was in grief, not because it replaced grief. So when your calamity comes, and it will, all of ours will, let your tears flow freely and let us weep with those who weep, and don't give out some cheesy Reader's Digest version of counsel. Just cry. Two more, then I'll close our time. Third truth that we see in here, and it's going to go from hard to harder. God grants to Satan limited power. We see this here. That's number one. Look at verse 12. Just go through this quickly. God says to Satan, behold, all that Job has is in your hand. Only against him do not stretch out your hand. And then verse 6, God says, behold, Job is in your hand. Only spare his life. God sets the limits of Satan's power. We need to understand that. Everything that Satan does is limited by God. As one commentator put it, you know, he may be a lion, but he's a lion on a leash. He's a lion on a leash. God reins him in or gives him slack according to his own sovereign purposes, which leads to the hardest thing that I think some of us will hear today, and that is this. Satan's work is ultimately the work of God. I want to highlight this for you. Look at the two heavenly scenes. We notice these. God handed Job over to Satan's power, but when Satan had done the work of taking Job's wealth and family, look at what Job says in verse 21. Satan's done it all, right? He gave him the freedom. God gave him the freedom with some reigning, right? Limitation. And what does Job say? The Lord gave and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. The Lord gave and the Lord took away. Job says it was ultimately the Lord himself who took away his family and his wealth. Then the writer of the book of Job makes a comment to avoid something. He wants us to understand that there's not a misunderstanding of what Job has said, and to ensure that no one says that Job should have attributed Satan's work to God, look at what he says in verse 22. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. Meaning that, oh, perhaps Job in his mourning just said it. And he wasn't privy to the exchange. He didn't know what was going on. He just said it. And the writer of the book of Job says he has charged no wrong to God. Similarly, look at the second heavenly scene. Look at verse 6 of chapter 2. What God says to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life. Limitation. You can only do certain things. Then verse 7, it makes it very explicit that Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck him. Satan struck him with sores. But now look at verse 10. Job says, shall we receive good from God and shall not receive evil? Or calamity? Better word, probably. In other words, Job again goes all the way up to the sovereignty of God over Satan and says that his sickness is from God. Satan may have been the nearer cause, but ultimately it's from God. And again, the writer warns us not to criticize Job here. He writes at the end of verse 10. Look at verse 10. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. He didn't say anything wrong about God. In other words, it's not a sin to say that there is a sickness that Satan causes, but it's from the Lord. I said a couple of weeks ago that I don't have a problem saying that God either orchestrates or permits, that he either orchestrates or permits, as long as we say, and again, all of these thoughts from a variety of individuals, I'm okay with saying God orchestrates certain things and permits certain things as long as we qualify it and say that God only permits those things that work according to his plan, purpose, and will. That there's not one thing that has taken place in the history of us that will not work according to his plan, purpose, and will. Not one. Some of you I know don't like this. But can I ask you a question in response? What's the alternative? What's your alternative? A God that's not in control? A God who steps back? A God who doesn't see beginning and end? How do we wrestle with this? How do we deal with this? How do we deal with a statement like, well, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away? Can we receive good but not calamity? How do we deal with that? This is how we deal with it. We deal with it in understanding what the intention is. What's the goal in mind for God? I talked about this a couple of weeks ago. One of the best verses, we say it too easily, that speaks into this, Genesis 50:20, where Joseph, a type of Jesus, looks at his brothers and said, what you intended for evil, God intended. Didn't just use, didn't just redeem, he intended it for good. He intended it for good. Which leads to what? More specifically, it leads to who? Jesus. Let me ask you a question. Did God will it for Jesus to suffer at the hands of lawless men and to be murdered? Or did that sort of sneak up on him? Just to make sure we understand this. Acts 2:23, Jesus, it says of Jesus by Peter, he was delivered up according to the definite plan and foreshadowing of God. And as Jesus himself said, my food is to do the will of him who sent me. And probably the most straightforward statement in regards to all of this discussion is Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane praying about the cup being taken from him. And how does he end that prayer? But not my will be done, your will be done. Now, were the people who killed Jesus on the cross guilty? Yes, Peter says they were lawless and evil, but what they intended for evil, God intended for good, for the salvation of us. It's intention, it's purpose, it's looking ahead. What is the intention of God, big picture in all of this? His glory, His glory. What's the most glorious act of God? Jesus on the cross. Jesus on the cross. The cross, first and foremost, is a depiction of how gracious and glorious our Father is towards us. What we've taken the cross to be is, man, you know what? God must really love me. Only we can take the cross and make it about us. Does God love us? Yes. Is that the number one picture of the cross? Not even close. It's the depiction of the glory of God. Let me close this time. In a passage that many of us have read many times, I think it puts the proper end to all of this. It wraps up what we see in the ministry of Jesus and what we read as the goal of the glory of the gospel. Philippians 2, and I'll read it on the screen. Philippians 2, 8 to 11. Why is there suffering? Why is there evil? Does God not care? Yes, he cared. He cared so much, he fleshed himself up and came. What's your solution? What's your solution? That's a fair question. Are you hoping that we just do better? What's your solution? What's God's? And being found in human form, Jesus humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death. There's suffering, there's evil, there's lawlessness, even death on a cross. Therefore, God has highly exalted him and bestowed on him the name that is above every other name. So that in the name of Jesus, every knee should bow, and in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is the Lord. For what end? To the glory of God the Father. Number one reason why suffering and evil and pain exists, to display, and I'm quoting, the greatness of the glory of the grace of God. What does that mean for us in our own lives? Ask the question at the beginning. Whose glory are you living for? Am I being trite over the difficult things in our lives? Not in your life. Do I have much to learn? I have so much to learn in this West Side. I don't know where to begin. I don't know where to begin. Would you stand as we respond? We're going to respond in worship through singing and giving and prayer. Our prayer couple in the back is Chad and Linda. They'll be in the back. If you want to pray with somebody, we respond in the table of grace. If you know Jesus and you're walking with him, come forward and partake in the table of grace. Chew on this. There are things that you need to confess, things you need to admit. If you don't know Jesus and you've been just living through this, trying to figure out what's right, today is the day for salvation. Come to Jesus. He is, and I mean this emphatically, he is the only hope, the only solution to pain and suffering. Because if you look at our world and think we've got it figured out, I don't know what to tell you, man. I don't know. We just maybe need to travel. It's one good thing about missions is we get out of kits and we see the world for what it is. Kits ain't that great either. It's nice, not that great. So let's respond in worship, and Pastor Chad will close our time. When you're ready, come down and partake with us in the table of grace.